Hello, I'm Sebastian. Welcome to Nine Gnar Trees Podcast. Today, I will summarize and review the book, How China Became Capitalist by Ronald Coase and Ning Wang is a non-fiction economic history that examines China's transformation from a rigid planned economy into a largely market-oriented system. Rather than treating the shift as a simple ideological conversion, the book traces how practical reforms, local experimentation, and changing institutional arrangements gradually open space for private activity, decentralized decision-making, and new forms of enterprise. The authors are especially interested in how economic outcomes depend on the rules, incentives, and property rights structures that shape exchange, production, and investment. Their account draws on Coase's long-standing emphasis on transaction costs and the importance of institutions, but it is presented primarily as a historical analysis of post-Mao reform. The book is valuable both as a study of China's development and as a broader reflection on how capitalism can emerge through incremental political and administrative change rather than through a neat theoretical blueprint. I will give you key takeaways from this book. Firstly, China's market transformation emerged through pragmatic reform, not instant ideological conversion. A central argument of the book is that China did not become capitalist through a clean break with socialism or a sudden embrace of free market doctrine. Instead, the transition unfolded through pragmatic policy changes after the Mao era, especially under Deng Xiaoping, when leaders prioritized results over ideology. The authors present this as a historically contingent process in which reforms were tested, adjusted, and often introduced first at the local level before being scaled up. This matters because it shifts attention away from abstract labels such as socialist or capitalist and toward the actual mechanisms that changed incentives on the ground. The book shows that the Chinese state remained deeply involved even as markets expanded, which is why the title is deliberately provocative: Capitalism in China, developed through state-guided experimentation rather than through a classic liberalization story. That framing helps readers understand why Chinese reform was uneven, politically managed, and often reversible in its early stages. Secondly, decentralization gave local officials room to experiment with economic change. The book emphasizes decentralization as one of the key institutional forces behind China's economic rise. Power over economic decisions gradually moved away from the central government and toward provincial, municipal, and township authorities, giving local officials incentives to pursue growth, attract investment, and support new businesses. This mattered because central planning had concentrated decisions in ways that often ignored local conditions, while decentralization allowed policies to adapt to regional differences and practical opportunities. The authors treat this as more than an administrative reform. It altered the structure of incentives inside the state itself. Local governments became participants in development, not merely enforcers of commands from above. In the book's account, this helped create a more flexible economic order in which entrepreneurship and local experimentation could emerge even before broader political or legal reforms were complete. The result was a system that looked partly socialist in form, but increasingly capitalist in function, because decentralized decision-making made economic adaptation faster and more responsive. Thirdly, the collectivization of agriculture released incentives that central planning had suppressed. Another major theme is the privatization and decollectivization of agriculture, which the authors identify as one of the pillars of China's transition. Under collectivized farming, individual incentives to produce efficiently were weak, and outcomes were often determined by bureaucratic allocation rather than direct rewards for effort. The reforms that allowed households greater control over land use and production radically changed those incentives. By linking work more closely to reward, agricultural reform increased output and improved rural livelihoods, while also freeing labor and resources for non-agricultural activities. The book presents this as a foundational step because it did not merely improve farm productivity, it also expanded the space for market exchange and rural entrepreneurship. Once agriculture began to operate on more individual and family-based incentives, the countryside could support broader commercialization, trade, and the emergence of small businesses. In this sense, agricultural change was not a separate chapter from China's industrial growth, but a precondition for it, since it helped create the social and economic surplus that later reforms could build upon. Fourthly, private entrepreneurship and special economic zones created a new commercial sector. The book also pays close attention to the rise of private entrepreneurship, especially in manufacturing and export-oriented activity. As reforms progressed, private firms and quasi-private enterprises found room to operate in sectors that had once been dominated by state planning. Special economic zones and related policy experiments played an important role by providing relatively permissive environments for trade, foreign investment, and business formation. These zones were significant because they allowed the state to test market rules without fully abandoning control over the wider economy. The authors use this to show how capitalism can develop through enclaves and exceptions before becoming more general. Entrepreneurship in the book is not treated as a purely cultural phenomenon or a heroic individual story. It is explained as the product of institutional space, legal tolerance, and incentive structures that made private initiative profitable. The rise of this sector is one of the clearest signs that China's growth was not simply state-led industrial expansion, but also a transformation in who could own, manage, and benefit from economic activity. Lastly, Coase's institutional economics explains why rules and property rights mattered more than slogans. The book is shaped by Ronald Coase's institutional approach to economics, which focuses on transaction costs, property rights, and the way real organizations function. Rather than assuming that markets automatically work whenever they are allowed to exist, Coase's framework asks how the cost of exchanging, coordinating, and enforcing agreements affects economic performance. That perspective is especially useful for China, where reforms changed incentives without immediately creating a fully liberal legal order. The authors therefore suggest that the Chinese case should be understood through institutional analysis: who has authority, who controls assets, how rights are defined, and what costs people face when they try to trade or invest. This is one reason the book is often read as both economic history and applied institutional theory. It also explains why the authors avoid a purely celebratory account of capitalism. They are interested in the conditions under which exchange becomes possible, not merely in whether markets exist in name. That makes the book distinctive among accounts of China, because it connects macroeconomic transformation to the micro-level structure of institutions. In conclusion, this book is best suited to readers who want to understand China's rise through the lens of economic institutions rather than through ideology, geopolitics, or high-level developmental slogans. Students of economics, political economy, modern Chinese history, and public policy will all find it useful, especially if they want a compact account of how reform actually worked in practice. Its main benefit is that it explains growth by tracing the interaction between state power, local experimentation, property rights, and entrepreneurial incentives. Readers come away with a clearer sense of why gradual, partial, and sometimes contradictory reforms can produce large structural change over time. Compared with many books on China that focus on leadership narratives or geopolitical interpretation, this one stands out for its institutional and historical method. It is also distinctive because it comes from Ronald Coase, whose work on firms and transaction costs gives the book a deeper analytical foundation than a standard country history, even when readers disagree with some of its conclusions. The book offers a rigorous framework for thinking about how capitalism can emerge inside a system that still claims socialist legitimacy. That combination of historical detail and institutional reasoning is what makes it especially valuable. If you would like to support R. Coase, you can buy the book through the Amazon link I've provided in the podcast description. After reading the book, please let me know what you think and share your thoughts. See you around.